You're listening to WBH Radio, your host William Holly, episode number 60. I'm on the road this week. I'm in Johnson City, Tennessee, going to participate in commencement 2021, where my doctorate of education in global sport leadership will be conferred by the prestigious East Tennessee State University. And joining me is a gentleman who was my professor on multiple occasions, but he's much more than that. He's the program coordinator. He played a pivotal role in helping leading us abroad in our study abroad portion in Germany and Amsterdam. He's a certified athletic trainer. He's an advisor to East Tennessee State Athletics, a gentleman and a scholar, Dr. Brian Johnston. Dr. Johnston, how you doing?
I am doing great. Thank you very much. It's great to see you in person again.
For sure. It's been a while. I want to thank you for joining my show, and thank you for allowing me to record here in the friendly confines of East Tennessee State University. Dr. Johnston, where exactly are we recording this podcast from right now?
We are actually in William B. Green Stadium, which is home of EGSU football team, and we're up in the President's Box. And Dr. Nolan will he'll be the one to give you the official nod that you will be Dr. Holly tomorrow at 1 o'clock.
Oh, that's cool, man. I look forward to that. That title still makes me a little nervous and uneasy. Like, I got to do a lot more work before I get comfortable with the doctor designation.
Well, I tell you, it's a well-earned degree, and it's a well-earned title. So don't ever feel like you don't deserve it or that you hadn't earned it.
That's what's up. Thank you. Thank you. Let's talk about that degree. The last 3 years, I have been pursuing my doctorate of education in global sport leadership. And people always ask, well, what's that? So, Dr. Johnston, if you can help us out, what is a doctorate of education in global sport leadership?
Sure. This program was set up and designed specifically for people who are working in sport in a way that they could continue doing their job while still taking classes. Mm-hmm. And so you're never really a full-time student, but the workload is right on the edge.
Yes.
And so the program is, when it was, again, a lot of practitioners are nervous about seeing a dissertation and, you know, oh, I'm never going to be able to complete a dissertation. I don't have time for that. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to come up with a model that allowed them to get academic content that was applicable to now, real world things, but also to be able to not have to fear this giant research paper. Mm-hmm. And so we do a capstone project, and it's a digital portfolio. And this portfolio allows each student, by the time they finish, to be able to present their leadership philosophy, their knowledge of internal and external operations, a small research segment, and then there's some miscellaneous things kind of thrown in that we really want our students to be creative and really explore their interests to be able to put that in. And when it's put together, it's a nice digital representation of that professional.
Yes, yes. What can you say specifically about the curriculum? Like, what are you preparing the students to go out and do?
So we have a lot of college people that work in college mm-hmm. athletics, but we have people that work in professional sport. We have people that work in high schools. Mm-hmm. And when you come into any job, especially in a business, you come in on an internal side or an external side, and your career path takes you down that road, and it's very difficult to jump back and forth. Yes. And so at this point in all of our students' careers, they've become comfortable in which side they're on. Yes. And we want to give them a good foundation of the other side so that when they become a leader, maybe they become a general manager, or they become an athletic director or just a department head, they now have a better understanding of not just their area, but they can appreciate what other people are doing as well.
Absolutely. What role did you play in helping to create this program? Because it's fairly new. The first graduating class was in 2018.
Yes, sir. So Dick Sander, he was our athletic director years ago, and he was walking to a meeting one day, and my office happened to be open, and he said, hey, I need you to come to a meeting and see what you think. And so I was met with the provost and the dean of the graduate school, and we talked, and I really was just kind of taking notes and feeling things out. I had no aspirations or thoughts. I had just became associate athletic director for student athlete welfare. Right. I was still working in sports medicine, doing things. And within a few weeks, here I am writing curriculum. Mm-hmm. And It's so Dr. Sanders' career is legendary in NCAA athletics. And I mean, he's been such an influence on so many people.
Yeah.
And what quickly became my job was taking all of the things in his head and putting it on paper. And so we would sit down and we would say, okay, what are the areas that need to be addressed? What are the needs? And so he would start to just talk and I would write down. And then we actually surveyed athletic directors that were currently sitting and we said, okay, if you're looking for someone to be a deputy AD or to take over your fundraising, what skills do you want them to have? And so we took the results of those phone calls and surveys and just all of the data that we could compile so that we made sure we fit what was needed in the job market. What are the skills that athletic directors and supervisors want? How can we take that and put it in the curriculum in such a way that our students get what we want them to?
Nice. You mentioned Dr. Sander.
Mm-hmm.
He's the first professor you have when you enter this program.
Yes.
He teaches the initial course. And he has 25-plus years of being an athletic director.
Yes.
What specifically do you think he saw or you saw out there in the marketplace that motivated you guys to put this together at that particular time? Was there something specific?
So Dr. Sander has always... He's a great visionary,
mm-hmm.
and he sees things in people, and he goes and gets it. Like, I mean, if he sees a trait in someone that wants to get better,
yeah.
he's going to go after that because he wants to motivate them. If he sees someone that's not very motivated, it's almost like they're invisible to him. And so his whole career, and if you go back to what he did at VCU with the Sports Center and Villa 7 and now with Top Connect Leaders,
okay.
it's amazing because his whole life has been dedicated to helping other people get better and better themselves.
Right.
And for him, I mean, education is a huge, huge thing for him. He really wanted for leaders to have the opportunity to be able to get that terminal degree because, one, it does show commitment, mm-hmm. but it's an investment in yourself. And when you learn how to invest in yourself and you can accomplish something, as you move down the road and when something else comes open, you're not hesitant to take a risk. You're not hesitant to not put that investment in because you know that it's worth it.
For sure. I got kind of like a two-part question for you. First, how would you define leadership? Because leadership is the overarching theme in this program. No matter what mm-hmm. class you're taking, if it's analytics, if it's law, the overarching theme is leadership. So how would you define leadership? And also, what would you say to those who question the legitimacy of leadership as an academic discipline?
Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting word, leadership.
Yes, sir.
We have an opportunity in the last semester for our students in their third year to come up with their leadership philosophy.
You did.
And it's very difficult. It's a hard assignment because you really have to kind of think, okay, what do I mean when I talk about my leadership philosophy? And rather than a nice, you know, simple definition, you know, leadership kind of has varying definitions at
yes.
certain times. It's very situational. There are times where leaders need to be supportive. To me, the number one skill of any great leader is the ability to listen. I think, and it's not just hearing what's going on, but it's being able to listen to allow the person speaking to know that you're listening.
Yes.
And so it's, for me, it's not necessarily a specific definition as it's a lot of traits.
Yeah.
So I think of being a good listener, being very supportive, you know, defending your staff, defending others.
Mm-hmm.
Because when a group of people want to follow someone,
mm-hmm.
that's a powerful thing. And when you do it because I know this person's got my back no matter what, that's leadership.
For sure, for sure. In fact, I just finished teaching my own college course, right? Shout out to SUNY Farmingdale. And I taught leadership and ethics, and I was using the textbook and the definition they had of, I believe, leadership is an influence relationship that helps to organize people to accomplish a common goal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just about your position or I'm the boss. When you can get people to follow you on their own, like, great things can happen. And in fact, it was a class you taught that I really enjoyed. It's called Interpersonal Relationships in Sport. You know, we all have our own opinions. We all come from my own side of the tracks, but can you understand and have empathy for someone else? You know, understand their journey, where they're coming from, their opinion. And I think that, to piggyback off what you said, is a great quality of a leader. You know, getting us all together, galvanizing the troops, and getting us to move in one direction and accomplish a goal. All right. So, Dr. Johnson, to those who question the legitimacy of leadership, like, I'm a boss, I'm a CEO, I got a staff of 10, I'm a leader. I don't need any formal education in that field. What would you say to that?
Well, I think you said it in your defense. Leadership is constantly evolving. Mm-hmm. It depends on, as we grow, as we mature as individuals, leadership is a skill that's unlike any other skill that you have. If you don't use it, you're not as sharp. And so it's being able to invest in yourself, to take time to read a book, to take time to go to a seminar, take time to take a class, to put yourself outside of your comfort zone. You know, you and I have talked about that quite a bit when you're thinking exactly what you said earlier about trying to see through someone else's eyes, mm-hmm. look through another different lens. So the legitimacy of leadership programs, when I hear people talk down on those, yes. it shows me that they're closed-mindedness because everyone can learn. And when the day that learning stops is the day that you need to go sit on the dock and feed the ducks, because every day you can learn something. And as a leader, it's critical because everything changes. Think about the last year. What just happened, and how leaders had to pivot to work to support people working at home. They had to figure out how they were going to get their message across. Mm-hmm. They had to figure out, how am I going to work with my staff to continue being productive? What are they dealing with? You know, when I say, okay, you can work from home, we have 3 kids at home and 2 dogs, and your cat's always walking on your computer. So how can we set this up? And so being able to constantly learn and take in as much as you can, those are the people who are successful. Mm-hmm. You know, those are the ones that you really watch and you say, there's something special there.
Yeah. I think it was actually in one of the books during this program. I can't remember which one it was. They said, managers work on the business, leaders work on the people. Mm-hmm. You know, and the human creature is no different than animals, right? There's, you can study different things and learn how to motivate individuals, how to galvanize people. There's a science to it, you know, and I feel like that's what I got from this program, you know. And I go back to that course that you taught, you know, being able to connect, being able to get individuals to move in one direction, regardless of what your title is. Mm-hmm. You know, when I think of a leader, I think of, like, if we were all stranded in the woods, like, would people want to follow you?
Right.
You know, not because you're their boss or you holding their paycheck. Will they be able to look at you and trust you to lead them to prosperity? All right. Is there a part of this program? It's a 3-year program. Mm-hmm. Is there a part of this program that you think may be most important or most essential to helping transform individuals and get them on the path to being the leader they aspire to be?
Honestly, I think the very first trip, because the program is designed, we take 2 classes in the fall, 1 in winter session, 2 in the spring, May term, which is a 3-week term, and then 2 classes in the summer. And you do that the first 2 years. And in the May term, of that 3-week period, that's when we do our field experience and mm-hmm. we go overseas. And I think that very first trip is kind of that moment where you've jumped in the deep end. I think the strategic planning class is very difficult because the material is just, sometimes it's really hard. Mm-hmm. The leadership class is great. And then in winter session, we do the interpersonal relationships yes. class. But then in the spring, you've got research and you're kind of just, oh, you know, it's really academic kind of things. Yes. But when we go over and you have to, for some people, they've never been out of the country. And so we hop on that airplane and we land, and we don't all land at the same time. No. People have to figure out where to go. We're going to meet here. They make it, we get there, we get on the bus. The class has never met each other. This is the first time.
Yeah.
And what I see consistently is after that first trip, people get together. It's the quality of the work improves. Mm-hmm. I think part of it is you can put a voice with a face
yes.
for me and Dr. Sayers, but also while we're there, just, you know, when you're taking young kids on a trip like that, mm-hmm. it's very regimented. We have to do this, we have to do this, we have to do this. You don't have to be that way. You can be very flexible.
Yes.
We can be very, you know, if when you treat people with respect and you give them, hey, this is what we're doing, just meet me there at this mm-hmm. time, it's great. And I think you start to take those lessons that we learn early in the program, and all of a sudden they're in real world application.
Yes.
Because we're meeting with the technical directors for these teams, you know, in the Eredivisie League and in the Bundesliga, and we're visiting, you know, the Berlin Wall. You know, we're there. I mean, right. We are right there. We're at Checkpoint Charlie. We're doing those things where some of the most famous things in history have happened, and we're standing there and we're soaking it up. And I really enjoy that part of it.
Yes.
And I think that's when it happens. If you had to say what class, it'd be tough to pick one specific class, but I think bits and pieces of classes, you put them together. And I think introducing everybody to the Adobe Spark program, as simple as that is a great thing.
Yeah.
Because every, you know, technology can be intimidating.
It sure can. So, yes, for me specifically. No, but the Adobe Spark was great.
Yeah, and you can do so many things with it, and it kind of gets your foot in the door to be able to do many other things. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But then I also think some of the group projects, they're huge, huge. The brand audits, being able to learn how to tell the story of a brand, those are the little things that kind of come together.
For sure, for sure. Going back to the trip, you mentioned some people not being out of the country, like, I was on that list, you know, outside of deploying to Iraq as a veteran, like being in Europe for the first time. During my trip, we went to Germany and Amsterdam, and it was an eye-opener. You know, I fancy myself as a sports guy, but you ain't a sports guy until you sat down and you seen a professional football game, soccer game, excuse me, football, as they say in Europe. But when you sit back and see the spectacle that is soccer, like, wow, this is different.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that really opened my eyes that there's a whole world outside of there. We went to an equestrian facility, mm-hmm. and I'm sitting there, a kid from Brooklyn, petting horses. You're right. That was really a great experience.
So that is a great example. think about the emotional intelligence lecture that we got from Mark Sharman about having the horse and the rider and the relationship that they had to have. And then how applicable that was from what we did in class, but then just in real life.
Yeah.
I mean, that's probably my favorite thing that we've done in all the trips, mm-hmm. because that was the most impactful 2 hours. I mean, that guy was great.
Yeah.
And to hear how those, you know, it's a 3-year process just to get to that point.
Yeah.
So, and they were talking about, you know, they were going to go to the Tokyo Olympics, and they were taking the horses and putting them in the planes and taking off and landing to get them accustomed. Remember, they're about being just in the air.
Yeah.
And so a lot of those details, it's not something we think about. You take it for granted. There's a lot of job opportunities there.
Yeah, yeah.
So
I have forgot about that. That's right. They would put the horse on a plane, fly him in the air for a second, and bring him down just so they could get acclimated.
Yeah.
So they would be prepared for the long flight to go to the Tokyo Olympics and go out there and compete. And you're right, you talk about that emotional intelligence, being able to connect, being able to understand even without language. And that's something great leaders, that's a quality that helped them be successful. You know, even with your people, your constituency, your workers, somebody's at their desk, their head down, you need to understand. Maybe they're having a bad day. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's not the day to jump all on them, you know what I'm saying? Maybe they need a pat on the back. Wow, I had forgot about that. There was so much going on in that trip overseas. I remember Team Handball.
Yeah,
a whole sport I didn't even know exists.
Yeah,
there's professional athletes, fans yelling and screaming, like Team Handball. In Brooklyn, we just hit the ball against the wall. We call that handball. But over there, it was like a mesh of basketball and soccer. It was absolutely phenomenal. That is a big deal, going overseas. One thing I like about the program is that no matter, it covers a lot of ground. You know, we talk about the relationships, leadership, but there's also analytics, mm-hmm. there's law. So no matter what your strengths are, there's going to be a point where the program tests you mm-hmm. and asks you to step outside of your comfort zone.
Right.
I know for me, it was a few times. Technology, when Dr. Johnson said, we're going to do Adobe Spark, I said, man, Can't do PowerPoint. I had to learn a whole different program. So I want to ask you, feedback from the students, what do they view as most challenging? I'm going to say for me, it was twofold. Analytics course. Mm-hmm. I ain't the numbers guy. It was hard. I had to get on that Excel sheet. I'm calling classmates, asking for help. But it's a viable tool for me to have. Mm-hmm. And the law class, like, we reading law documents. I'm like, this legalese, like, this is like hieroglyphics to me.
Yeah.
But it was challenging. And as people go out in the field and your ADs and stuff, you need to be able to at least understand that document. Mm-hmm. So no matter who you are and what your skills are, this program is going to push you. So I ask, as you get feedback from the students, what would they say is maybe most challenging?
Without a doubt, Research 2 is the class that people like the least. Yeah. And what we do in that class is a research stats class, basically. And we try to teach everyone how to do statistical calculations using Excel.
Yes.
There are other programs out there, SPSS, you can do Minitab. There are a lot of software programs that are there, but very rarely, if you're working in a normal office, you're not going to have access to that. Mm-hmm. But if we show you how to do it with Excel, and sometimes it takes a couple of extra steps, but if we can teach you in Excel, no matter where you are, you're able to do that. Yes. And so it's teaching you, it's almost like a survival skill. And a lot of people, when the class is over, they sigh and they're like, okay.
Yeah.
And then after Research 2, that summer, the analytics class rolls around and they're like, wow, I'm glad we did this in the spring.
Yeah.
So analytics have become a huge component of sport, and we don't get very deep, but we do want, exactly like you said, to give you enough foundation so that you're able to go in, and if somebody, you know, people say, why do we have to do this research stuff? And I said, well, here's what's going to happen. Someone's going to bring you an article and say, I want to buy this for my team or my office or whatever, and they said, there's the research to support it. And when you look at it, and all of the subjects are on 65 and 70-year-old men and women, and they're wanting to buy something for 18 to 22-year-olds, it's like, hey, you know, that may not be the best article to support this. Mm-hmm. And so, no doubt, the research class and the analytics are the two. You know, and the law class, you get some, but, you know, we met with Martin Shimke from the Court of Arbitration of Sport, and he talked about, he gave us the brief, the ruling on the Samaya Castor case.
Right.
And He was able to explain it in such a simple manner.
Yes.
But it's so complicated. And I know Kay in the law class, you know, Kay's an attorney.
Kay
Lennon McGrew.
Mm-hmm.
And she's been in athletics for a long time, and that's kind of her passion. But when she starts talking legalese, as you say, she gets in her zone, and a lot of times I even have to say, hey, no, wait a minute. Tell me exactly what you said in English.
Yeah.
So
what type of career paths do graduates embark on?
We have quite a few that have gone on, and maybe they're in an assistant AD level, and now they're an associate AD, or they were trying to make that next jump. Mm-hmm. We have some folks that work at the high school level that have been able to move into a principal role. Neil Krantz, who graduated in the second cohort, he's at high school in Guam, and he works there on the base, and he was promoted to athletic director. And so we've had, you know, the majority of our students do something that their job has improved in some way. Sometimes it's an entirely new job. Right. Taylor Toner just walked across the stage yesterday as the class of 2020, and she started in the program as the assistant ticket manager. While she was in the program, she was assistant ticket manager at ETSU, the ticket manager, director of tickets at Western Carolina, and then the year that she graduated, she was the CFO for the University of Arkansas, Little Rock.
Wow.
And so we've had a couple, Nikki Golston in your class.
Yes.
She's gonna graduate with you tomorrow.
Nikki.
And she has gone from Memphis to Toledo, and now she is at the University of South Carolina doing amazing things, absolutely amazing things. So the career path really is kind of individualized, but
yes,
Everybody's been able to kind of find their niche there. I mean, when you told me what you were doing now, I was super excited. And what a great opportunity that's been, because you've been able to take assignments and tailor them,
yes,
for those needs. And that's kind of the heart of the program.
Yes, yes. I want to ask you about academia. You know, I just finished my first semester as an adjunct professor at SUNY Farmingdale, where I taught leadership and ethics in sports. Dr. Johnson, I really look forward to a career in academia because I feel it's like the last bastion of truth. You know what I'm saying? You look on TV, you got your right wing media, you got the left wing. I turn on ESPN and Fox Sports, and I know there's certain conversations I should never expect to see on those platforms. But as a scholar, you know, we're in search of the truth. Mm-hmm. You know, we can do research, we can discuss controversial figures, you know, have civil discourse. How fair of an assessment is that of academic life? Someone who's been in academia for some time.
I think it varies. There are some topics that are so controversial and so toxic that you almost have to let time go by and allow some common sense, I guess, to kind of seep in. Because right. Some people, they get so triggered on things.
Yes.
And so when they're... there are topics that just, it's tough. And just like you said, the search for the truth is there, but sometimes people don't want to take the journey.
Right.
I think more importantly, as in the world of academia, you have to provide the evidence that's out there, mm-hmm. even if it's what people don't want to hear.
Unpopular, yes.
Yeah, and I know, like in your research paper, where you had pros and cons of things. Here are examples good, here are examples bad. Yeah. I think that's... When a controversial topic comes up, to be able to address both sides and to look at those and say, you know, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Here's what this group found. Why was this group able to find a different response? Mm-hmm. So it is. It's tough. And right now, with social media and everybody's camera phone, it's really hard to get, okay, what really happened? Because right. everybody's angle is a little bit different, and you're going to present through your eyes, mm-hmm. so to speak, and maybe... You came in halfway through something, you know, and it's tough. It is tough, but there's no denying that you're going to see things from so many angles,
yes.
and your opinion is going to be totally influenced by which channel you watch, mm-hmm. and which personality you want to hear.
Yeah.
So,
with the increase of politics and social issues in sport. You know, we continue to see the intersection, speaking of controversial topics. How does that change the landscape for leaders in sport?
It's very tough. and I say that because good leaders in sport right now are the ones who are anticipating this could be a potential problem. Let's address it now. Mm-hmm. This could be a situation that with our demographics, our donor base, this could be something that we need to manage, and so let's get on the front end. Mm-hmm. I think when you sit back and you cross your fingers and you hope nothing's going to happen, that's when things go bad. Mm-hmm. You know, the good leaders that are out there in sport are the ones who are saying, all right, we're going to deal with this now. Let's make a plan. Mm-hmm. There's a current student in the program who is an athletic director out in Fresno, and he and I have talked a lot about that, and yeah. he's kind of bouncing off, you know, here's our plans for this, and this is what we've done. It's worked out very well. Mm-hmm. So I think the planning of those type things, that's huge.
Mm-hmm. Kind of being like on a proactive side.
Yes.
That's good. East Tennessee State men's basketball program recently had a coach step down.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking at an article in the Players Tribune, and it was written by a young ETSU basketball player. Mm-hmm. And they spoke about a possible reason for the coach stepping down is because the coach has supported them when they decided to take a knee during the national anthem. The player went on to say that there were some people on campus, maybe fans, who were unhappy with their decision to take a knee, which possibly led to the coach stepping down. I'm not asking you about that specifically. I want to ask you, what advice do you have for leaders in those positions? Because one thing I learned from the program is that there are multiple stakeholders.
Mm-hmm.
Right? When you're in these positions of power, positions of authority, positions of leadership, it's not just as simple as, oh, those are my players. You got the players, you got your superiors and an athletic director or a college president. You have the fan base, you have donors, boosters, sponsors. What advice would you give to leaders who find themselves in tough situations and stakeholders pulling in different directions? How do they pull it all together and again, put their organization in a position to be successful?
I think it's all about being proactive. I think if, you know, when the decision to kneel for our, by our players was one where the planning of that could have gone better. I mean, I think everybody would say that 100%, if we're going to do that, let's do something else. You know, I think from a leadership standpoint, it's saying, okay, we're supportive of this decision.
Yeah.
We're going to anticipate this pushback, so how are we going to respond? How are we going to do that? And so I think being able to anticipate, okay, what could happen? If this happens, then how are we going to address it? And we have to have a unified front, because what you can't have in an organization, whether it's a sport organization or whether it's a company on Wall Street, you cannot have a fractured response. You have to be a totally unified response, and the leader has to be the person at the very front who, if there's a bunch of mud being slung, they need to take it. You know, the staff that works there, they're not the ones that deserve the mud, because they have no say one way or the other. But the people who are making the decisions to either prepare or not prepare, they're the ones that have to be in the front saying, this is what's happening, this is what we're going to do, being proactive. And we talk about it, and you hear the word transparency is abused so much.
Right.
It's the most abused word in the English language.
Right.
And so just being honest.
Yes.
I mean, it's not hard to just tell the truth. And it makes for a very difficult situation.
That's something I was going to throw in there, just being transparent, being honest about who you are, be honest about, hey, I understand this decision you're going to make, but these may be some possible consequences. You know, are you willing to face it? And that's another thing I want to ask you. Sometimes I look on TV and I start to feel sorry for some of these leaders in certain positions because they're not equipped to handle certain conversations, and they don't want to. They say, hey, I just want to coach basketball. I just want to coach football.
Right.
But the landscape is changing. Dr. Johnson, what advice would you give to those individuals who don't want to partake in these conversations that are starting to take place and take shape around the globe? They just want to do their job. What advice would you give to them?
Unfortunately, right now, I don't know that that's an option. Mm-hmm. I think right now, if you're a head coach, you've got to have these conversations with your team, because when you do, your team knows where you stand, and you know, and the coach knows where the players stand. I think it's the same in a normal athletic department or at a high school or anywhere. That when the leader says, guys, girls, this is out there. Let's talk about it. Is this bothering you? Is it not bothering you? Do you want to do something about this? Is there a way that we can go and show support? It comes down to different things, because when coaches don't communicate with their team, and they it's basically, we're going to go out and we're going to play and then everybody goes home. Mm-hmm. That's the job. That's kind of a NBA kind of style.
Right.
But in the college setting, very few people make it to the pros. It's just not, I mean, you know, even with the European leagues, you're teaching those individuals you're teaching them lessons that they're going to carry with them. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, if you're not open and communicating with them, you're modeling a behavior that whether they understand it or not, they're taking with them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, coaching is one of the hardest professions, because it's not just X's and O's. Coaching is helping young people transition.
Yes.
It's hard. It's hard. I mean, you've worked with college athletes. They come in, they're not sure about themselves. They were great players at their school, their high school. Mm-hmm. They get to college, and now all of a sudden there's a lot of great players. And even though they're great, they're like right here underneath. You know, they're not where they need to be, and they have to work hard again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard. It is. It's hard because your feelings get hurt. You know, you're away from home. You don't have the home crowd cheering your name anymore.
Right.
It's a very hard thing. Mm-hmm. One of the best coaches that I've seen manage these kind of situations was Steve Forbes.
Steve Forbes.
He's now at Wake Forest.
Mm-hmm.
But every one of his players were required to come to his office every day and just say, hey. And it was a way for him to have conversation and interaction. And they knew when he was going to be there, and he made sure he was there. But that, you know, his players loved him. And he was hard on them. Now, he coached them hard. But when it wasn't a coaching, I mean, he could get on one. Like, he could get on you, for example, and then the next time you did something great, he's praising you. I mean, it's not a one-way thing. It's both ways. Mm-hmm. But I think that love that you show by having interaction, mm-hmm. that's way better than just words.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Real quick on Steve Forbes. He used to coach you at ETSU, and now he's over at Wake Forest. This was, I believe, 2017. I was doing some work with the NCAA, and I was actually sitting at the scorer's table during one of the NCAA tournament games. And it was the Orlando first round, and one of the teams there was ETSU. And I'm just watching him and his interaction with the team. And in that short weekend, I thought, yo, that dude is special.
Yeah.
That dude is special. His players are willing to ride for him. It's not just I don't like when people talk about players, coaches. He's here to win games. Mm-hmm. He's also here to lead men.
Right.
And it seemed like he was doing both, being fair,
right,
being honest. You know what I'm saying? It's not like one side. Players, coach makes me think like he gives them ice creams for breakfast.
Yeah.
No, that's not the case. But when I saw, and that was actually the first time I actually became aware of East Tennessee State University. First time I had heard of it. So, yeah, that's dope. Steve Forbes. But you mentioned the job is no longer simply just about winning games.
Right.
And it never really was that. It's about the development of young athletes.
Right. I mean, another great example. So my 9-year-old had a soccer game today, right?
Yes.
It's not about winning games. Mm-hmm. It's about teaching them the game. It's about teaching them about space. It's about when a kid gets knocked over, help them up. Mm-hmm. It's about parents, you know, supporting everybody, not just their team. And it's those lessons that we model at a very young age that really shape kind of how these young kids, what their perception of sport is. On the field beside us, there was a girls' game going on, and it was super intense. And the parents are screaming, and they're cheering, and it was all positive. It was great, and it was super intense. And the game ended. It was a one-goal differential. And when the game was over, all the parents from the other teams, they were high-fiving each other. Because it was just such a great atmosphere.
Yeah.
And then the girls, you know, the girls that lost, they were upset they lost, but it was okay. And the parents, I mean, they cheered hard, and they were exhausted. You know, it was like they played in the game. And so they went to the visiting team parents and high-fived. And it was just it was a great moment, mm-hmm. because it doesn't always happen that way.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why I think this program is great, because it feels like America at times is losing its morals and ethics when it comes to sport. The intention of the games, mm-hmm. are being lost. It's just wins, loss, and money. You know what I'm saying? So we are in need of leaders that are going to go out there and make the difference and shift the sports world back to its intention, teaching valuable lessons, teamwork, like all of that cool stuff. And in turn, that's what the focus should be. And hopefully at the end of the day, you win a championship.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? But it shouldn't be the reverse. Diversity and inclusion, mm-hmm. is a hot topic in collegiate athletics and professional sports. How important is it for schools to be diverse and inclusive? Like, how valuable is it for staffs to have diversification?
Well, first I want to say something about this program. Mm-hmm. I have learned so much from the students in the program, mm-hmm. in that regard. And everybody has, you pick your own topic of interest for research, but I get to read everybody's papers. And so reading the papers that are submitted on minority females in leadership roles, to, you know, multiple people looking at coaches, you know, female coaches, minority coaches in basketball, for example, reading the history, learning what's there, because it's not something that's just on my radar I'm going to see.
For sure.
And so it's made me better, because I'm much more aware, I'm much more knowledgeable of what's going on. Right now, the trend in athletics is to have a diversity and inclusion DEI person in your department. Yes. So Keith Johnson, who is, he's the chair of the Department of Engineering, he's the head of diversity, equity, inclusion at ETSU, and Calvin Claggett is the person in the athletic department. And it's been great, because we have much more broad search committees. We are We're doing a lot more education. And again, it's another example of self-investment. So Jen Fry has come in and spoken to the department a couple times, and she's fantastic. But we've, you know, it's something that needs to happen, because the problem is, you say, well, I don't really have an issue. It's like, well, part of the reason you don't have an issue is because you're not aware.
Right.
And so, you know, that's the hardest obstacle, I think, because everybody's like, no, I don't think there's a problem. It's like, well, actually, that is the problem.
So
Dr. Johnson and Calvin do a great job with our department right now, and honestly in the university.
So how can schools get on the path to making sure they don't have any blind spots, making sure that they are viewing minority candidates and know what's going on outside of their small bubble?
It's hard.
Yeah.
And I think the mistake that a lot of places make is that they find someone in a department in an area and they just give them a title,
right.
But they don't have any preparation. You know, you wouldn't hire somebody to be the director of compliance just because. They have to have, they need to have a background. There's a preparation component to these DEI positions that are coming up. That education piece is not where it needs to be. It, you know, we've got to get something better. We've got to have, maybe it's a graduate certificate, maybe it's an actual degree. I don't know, but there's got to be some kind of educational component, because if not, you're taking someone who's out of school, giving them a title, and then they're not real sure what to do. Mm-hmm. And that's unfortunate, because what the school does is they check the box that, okay, we've got this position field, but what are we actually doing with it? And so it's a tough one. It's very difficult, because, I wouldn't even know where to begin to go to say, okay, where can I go to become better at being this person?
Yeah.
And I don't know that that's out there yet.
Mm-hmm. All right. And I called one of my classmates one time, Sherman Morris. Shout out to Sherman Morris. And I just always would call him and pick his brain on things. And I'm like, is it just like a charity case when teams or schools look to hire a minority? He said they should also be looking to hire minorities because it helps the bottom line, mm-hmm. as well. Like, even from a business standpoint, when you have a more diverse staff, that leads to a more diverse fan base and customer base. And when an organization that's diverse makes decisions, they can account for the whole public.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? And that can lead to them being more successful. So even from a bottom line standpoint, schools should be invested in diversity. And that's one thing I appreciate about this program. Dr. Johnson, you and I are from two different cultures, but I always felt like you understood what I was trying to express or things that were on my mind. And even if you didn't know, or you would fight hard to understand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember one time I was a little upset about something that was going on in the class. And I wrote an email and I got on my militant stuff. I'm talking about Martin Luther King. I'm talking about Malcolm X. I'm talking about Stanley Tookie Williams, founder of the Crips gang. And Dr. Johnston jumped in. It wasn't his class, it was someone else. But again, he's the program coordinator. So he jumped in and Dr. Johnston started sending it right back. He started referencing different things that I was unaware of, and I was thoroughly impressed. I said, oh, snap, man, Dr. Johnston's on his game. Like, I felt like that was cool. He heard me out. He had his opinion. He understood different things. That was very cool. You know, because I know, especially for minorities, when we walk into different buildings, we can feel left out, feel alienated, but never during this program did I feel that way, and I'm very thankful for that.
Well, I appreciate that, because that's one of the things that we really, I guess we work at it. I don't know if we work at it, but we want to try to understand. I mean, the whole point we go overseas is to understand other cultures.
Yeah.
And we're going to Clarkston, Georgia next week with the class, and when they were describing that area, there is a four-block square, and there's over 40 languages spoke.
Wow.
Because there's such a diverse population. And so we're going to go and we'll learn as much as we can from those individuals and try to just hear their stories. I love it, because it makes me a better person.
For sure.
It makes me a better dad.
Yeah.
Because when my kids are in situations, now I have things I can tell them. I have examples. I can say, hey, you know, this, try this. This could be different. Try that. And so it's really, But that's been, it being personally, that's one of the biggest rewarding things for me.
That's great. I don't think I ever responded to that email. I was sitting at my computer with a smirk, like, wow, that was impressive. He got it. Dr. Johnson, I want you to put on your certified athletic trainer hat for a second. I was watching Pardon the Interruption the other day, and, you know, towards the end of the show, they do, like, the anniversary part. They were talking about John Stockton, mm-hmm. NBA Hall of Famer. And they said in his 19-year career, he missed 16 games. Dr. Johnson, some of our favorite players have missed 16 games this month in the NBA. What does the research say about, I guess, load management, or are humans becoming more frail? Why did it seem like the athletes of yesteryear, specifically in the NBA, were more durable?
It's a very interesting question, and I get it all the time in regards to baseball. Okay. But I'm gonna go basketball, and then I'm gonna go back to baseball. So I don't know that people are necessarily less tough or tougher. I think what we do now is very different. When Stockton and Malone and those guys were coming through, when they were growing up, I mean, they would play basketball. They didn't play basketball 12 months a year. Yes. I think now we're playing sports 12 months a year. We've got practice, and then we've got conditioning over here at this specialist, and then we've got our specialized coach for maybe shooting or whatever over here. And so we have a constant influx. There's never a time to kind of let the body heal. And my PhD is in sport physiology and mm-hmm. performance. And so we spend a lot of time tracking fatigue and looking at different markers and catapult data and looking at how can we manage the legs, for lack of a better term, of these mm-hmm. athletes, these soccer players, before a game. Or in basketball, where we have the monitors on them now, and we're looking at heart rate. And we can tell who's working hard and who's not working hard. And so you got a lot of, you know, data overload in some of this. And it's hard because you got a guy like LeBron James. His physique and his size, he was never going to be a guard if he would have played back then.
Yes.
I mean, he is an amazing human. I mean, his body is just, it's not like everybody else. And so as big as he is, his body takes a beating. I mean, it just does. And you know, for you to be at your top game, you know, you want to be rested. You want to be recovered. Mm-hmm. Professional sports, it looks glamorous, but oh my gosh, the travel.
It's tough.
It's just a grind, and it's such a long season. Now, I get asked this quite a bit in regards to pitchers.
Yes.
Why do people blow their elbow out? What's the deal with Tommy John? How is this happening? And so the way I usually describe it is you have everybody that plays high school, and there's pitchers, and there's this big group. And then out of that big group, there's a small percentage that can go play college baseball. Mm-hmm. Some of them, their body's able to withstand the stress, and so they're able to continue. And then there's a few of them that get picked, and they get to go to the major leagues, and they're playing the minor leagues and work their way up. Usually the ones whose bodies can withstand the stress, mm-hmm. they're the ones that go on and have a shot. Mm-hmm. Because there's tons of players that come through that are really, really good, and their body just can't handle the stress anymore, and it just breaks down. And a lot of times that genetics is the separator in pitching, for example. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you think about, you know, your time as a coach. Think about how many minutes you spend on the floor.
Yes.
I mean, just being on the floor, your back, your knees, your hips, all that, working through preparation. You're not sleeping a lot because you're doing film. Mm-hmm. I mean, coaches experience the same kind of thing.
It's funny because that was my next question as far as athletic training. You mentioned now guys are playing basketball 12 months a year. Mm-hmm. Guys are pitching 12 months a year. Working at the youth level in basketball, these kids are picking sports, their sport, at 7, 8, 9 years old. Oh, I'm a basketball player.
Yeah.
You can say what you want about Michael Jordan. He can hit a baseball.
Yeah.
Ken Griffey, the Hall of Fame baseball player, he loved playing basketball. Is sports specialization at a young age, is that a problem?
This is just totally my opinion, mm-hmm. but I'm not a big fan. Mm-hmm. I think the bigger variety of things that you can play, it allows your body to do things in different positions. It allows certain areas to rest. It just makes you a better all-around athlete. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's tough.
What about the families who fear that their child won't be able to keep up if they don't allow them to play one sport 12 months out the year?
It's hard. And that there's a lot of, that's where sometimes moms and dads have to understand that, you know, it, maybe it's not meant to be.
Right.
You know, I think sometimes they live through their kids and they dream of that college scholarship when they're a 7-year-old. Mm-hmm. But most of the people who are really good as a 7-year-old in Little League field, they're never any good because, you know, you want to develop.
Yes.
And if you're really good now, are you, how much, what's your ceiling?
Right.
So I think strength training plays a big, big role in a lot of it. I mean, I think if you can get strong, your body can withstand stress. But again, how early do you start that?
Right.
It's push-ups, it's pull-ups, it's being able to just do kind of body weight things early on. Makes a big difference. So,
Dr. Johnson, oftentimes throughout the program, I will call you and just kind of pick your brain. You know, you are an academic. You are, again, the background in athletic training. You're a fan. Like, just anything out there in the sports world that has your attention. Maybe on the business side, like, what do you have your eye on? What are you paying close attention to right now?
Right now, I'm kind of in a lull. I mean, I'm a big NFL fan. I'm a Pittsburgh Steelers fan through and through. And the draft just happened, and so I'm kind of wrapping my brain around the picks there. And, of course, the schedule's going to be released soon. I love that part of it. We're going down to Atlanta for the trip, mm-hmm. so we're going to go to a Braves game. I hadn't watched a lot of baseball,
right.
So I'm trying to watch a little bit of that. But I think for me, one of the biggest things in sport is watching how the transition of power from ownership, general managers, and the players.
Okay.
I mean, what's going on with Aaron Rodgers right now in Green Bay, mm-hmm. it's very mm-hmm. interesting because the head coach, I mean, he absolutely wants him back.
Yeah.
But, or at least that's the way it seems. I mean, why would you not? He's MVP, he's Hall of Famer. But something is wrong in that relationship, and it's broken. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that we'll ever know the truth, but that is a huge deal because there's a lot of teams that will be affected. And so watching the dynamic of how that goes, I love watching all of the stuff leading up to the draft, mm-hmm. people, the smoke in the mirrors, and, you know, it's an interesting thing. But, yeah, I'm at a point in my life where a lot of my sport now is around my – oldest son plays high school soccer. My middle son plays lacrosse for the high school, and my youngest is just playing rec league. So it's nice to kind of just unplug everything and just sit in the lawn chair and watch.
For sure. Speaking of that power struggle between owner, general manager, and athlete, it was in this program, traveling abroad to Germany, that we did maybe some lectures and studying with the Bundesliga.
Mm-hmm.
A German soccer league. And it was there that I learned that they have what's called a 50+1 rule, where they don't allow one individual to own more than 49% of a team. So basically the teams are owned by the fans, the public.
Right.
Which blew my mind. You mean to tell me there's no Jerry Jones, there's no Jim Dolan, there's no Jeannie Buss? The leagues belong to the people. And I plan on doing some more research on that, so I'm not going to say too much, all right? But then with this program, I was allowed to see that there is another form of ownership out there. Because growing up in America, you think, oh, of course, there's some guy in the skybox who owns all this. That's not how it goes around the globe. So that was great. We're about to get out of here. Dr. Johnson, if you could just tell the world how brilliant of a student I was, please.
William was absolutely fantastic. First in his class.
But we graduate September 9th, Doctorate of Education. And a lot of people are going to be graduating around the country, not only at the doctorate level, master's, undergraduate. And a lot of people want to break into sport. Mm-hmm. And no matter what level of education, that field is competitive.
Absolutely.
You know, you talk about the NBA, there's 30 teams. I mean, there's 30 head coaches, there's 30 general managers, 30 presidents, 30 head of legal, 30 head of ticket sales. It is limited.
Right.
So, Dr. Johnston, what advice would you give to individuals that look to making a career in sport, outside of the education, outside of the degree? What advice would you give them to go out and get on the path and be a part of the field that they want?
Don't be afraid to take a risk. Mm-hmm. You know, network. Go out and volunteer. Tell people, hey, can I help? Can I, you know, do you need a hand with this event? And meet as many people as you can. And if you can find the things that no one's really wanting to do, go do that and do it well. And then you're going to be asked, oh, well, you know what? That guy, he did this job, and it was, oh, it's a brutal job. He did a great job. Let's bring him on. Mm-hmm. And there's multiple stories. I mean, there's countless stories about that. I heard a gentleman speak to a sport management group at Bristol Motor Speedway about a month ago, and he was talking about someone who he really wanted to get into to NFL. He really wanted to get in, And they said, okay, well, we need somebody to drive our players to and from this facility. If you can do that, that'd be great. And so this person did that. And for 2 years, he did it for free. Mm-hmm. And it was a long drive. I mean, he's like a 40-minute drive. Yeah. And they kept saying, man, this guy keeps coming back. He does a great job. Players love him. Well, now he's assistant GM. Nice. And, you know, it's an opportunity where I cannot remember if you were with us on this class or not. We were at the KVNB, the Dutch National Soccer Program.
Okay.
But anyway, there was a speaker who was talking about how he was director of security.
I was there.
Yeah, and he had been at the Olympics. Yes. He had been with the World Cup. He had done all these things. And when we said, well, how did you get into that role? He's like, I just volunteered.
Yeah.
You know, and you volunteer, you do it. You say, hey, where are you all going to go next? Well, we're going here. It's like, okay, well, maybe I can get a little stipend or, you know, hook me up with a couple of meals. And so you do that, and he just, you know, it just kind of spirals. And I can think of so many times that we've had interns in the athletic department here who've gotten in and worked hard and done a great job, and either we hired them or we called somebody and said, this person is great for this position. You need to hire him right now. And that's how it works. And that networking just kind of continues.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Well, Dr. Johnston, thank you for joining me on the podcast. Thank you for leading our program the last 3 years. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I got a lot of knowledge, and I look forward to applying it. Like I told you guys, I've been studying and equipping myself with these tools to take over the world. All right? So, Dr. Johnston, thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. That's WBH Radio. I'm William Holly. Out. Oh.